You know, the simple order of worship that we engage in each week as was stated at the table is one of the greatest fillings and supplying of our needs of anything that we could experience. Some people look upon it with disparagement. Some of them throw off on it with, it seems like, embarrassment that they are called upon to be a part of something so simple. But may I urge you to, as the opening prayer urged, that we realize that God looks upon our heart. And gathering about the table as we do each Lord's Day for this renewed commitment, singing these hymns of praise and encouragement to each other as we're commanded, being led in prayer, offering up something of what we are, part of our time as it's represented in money, and then gathering around the open word as we listen for a message from God's word, is a very beautiful and simple way that our great and wise God has condescended to come and teach us each Lord's Day. And I bow my head before him in thanksgiving for that beauty and power of simplicity. The parable of the prodigal son that we have studied ends in a very beautiful way, doesn't it? It ends with a penitent prodigal returning home, weeping, running. It ends with a loving father running to meet him, throwing his arms about him, embracing him, kissing him much. It ends with restored sonship, a new robe, a new ring, new shoes, new hope, new life, new joy. My son was dead and is alive. He was lost and he's found. The parable of the elder brother is a companion parable. It begins in verse 25 of this 15th chapter of Luke. Now his elder son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what this meant. And he said to him, "Your younger brother has come, and your father has killed the fatted calf because he has received him safe and sound." And the older brother shouted for joy and ran to meet his brother, for he had been away a long time, and he had missed him exceedingly much. And when he came where he was, he embraced him. And the younger brother said, "I am sorry that I was so rebellious and wasteful. Please forgive me. I will make it up to you." But the older brother said, "We all make mistakes. Our father gave me a double portion. You shall have half of what I have." And they went into the father's table, arm in arm. How we wish it had ended like that. But how untrue to life it would have been had it so ended. How we wish that were true to life, but it's not. Because Jesus Christ dealt with life and directed his message to the heart of our needs, the parable of the elder brother does not go like that. Instead, it goes like this. He called one of the servants and asked what this meant. And he said to him, "Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fatted calf because he has received him safe and sound." But he was angry and refused to go in. his father came out and entreated him. But he answered his father, "Lo, these many years I have served you, and I never disobeyed your command. Yet you never gave me a kid that I might make merry with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your living with harlots, you killed for him the fatted calf." And he said to him, "Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to make merry and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found." That's the true story, not only in reference to what Jesus said, but so often it's the true story in relationship to the way life is lived. We see in this companion parable what you might call the prodigal who stayed at home, the elder brother, and his reaction to his younger brother. Very briefly, let me paint the picture in some other terms. Let me bring it down just very close. Jesus did the most beautiful job of it. There's no way I could improve on it. But let me bring it down for this occasion in a very brief expression of surrounding circumstances, perhaps. We first read about this young man and see him coming in from the field. This says something about him that's good. He's not to be condemned for all that he did. There are things that he did that are commendable. He was industrious. He was, we could assume, punctual. He was a man who stayed with his responsibilities. He was at home. And you could go on and on naming the things that he had about him that were good. On this particular occasion, as the curtain rises in this second act, we see this young man coming in from the field, coming to his father's house. And he heard all this music. And he heard, I don't know how you hear, dancing. But he got the impression that there was a lot of joy and happiness going on in the house. And he said, What is the meaning of this? He called one of the servants. And I can just imagine the servant said, "Oh," said, "your brother's back. He's come home. And your father's killed the fatted calf. We're having a party. Come on in. It's about ready to start." And then this man said, "I'll not come in." He refused, it says, to come in. I can imagine that the servant was taken back. I can imagine him fumbling for words. I can imagine him becoming sick in his stomach because something had come up that perhaps that he was not aware of. And out from this man came this vile, all this vitriolic, all of this that was so unbecoming. And the servant, it seems, as you would reconstruct it, would more or less find himself nervous and wanting to go on about his task, and he excuses himself and goes on about some busy work just simply to have something to do, maybe, because he's so embarrassed at what this young man said. He goes on in the house, and preparations are being made, and the calf is being killed and prepared, and it's about ready to eat, and things are just about ready, and you can smell the good things that are being prepared. The father continues to look outside, looking for his older brother or his older son, and he doesn't see him. And perhaps he expresses concern to two or three others. I wonder where he could be. He's always on time. It's time he was here. Perhaps he checked the sun and found, you know, that it was really time for his older son to be home. And then finally, this servant who knew apologetically comes and says, "Sir, your older son is at home, but he won't come in." And then I can imagine the feeling of sadness that must have overwhelmed the father. In the midst of all this joy and happiness, here comes this chilling, wet blanket news that the older brother refuses to have any part in it. And I know his father's heart was once again crushed. And it says his father went out and entreated him. It means that he begged him, please come in. Come in. It's your brother. He's home. We have this feast prepared. It's proper that we ought to give it for him. He's back alive. He was lost, and now he's found. He says, what's the matter with you? And then there spews out of this boy's mouth his resentment. He says, lo, these many years I've worked for you, and I've never disobeyed a command of yours. He begins to present his work record to his father. And you know he was probably right. He had worked hard, and he had obeyed his father's every command, it seems. And then not only does he present himself in such a favorable light, but then he casts a shadow upon everyone else. He said, you never gave me a kid that I might make merry with my friends. He begins to bring his father into judgment. He begins to say to his father, you have been a tightwad when it came to me. You showed preference in the sense that you kept me out of my fun times. And then thirdly, he brings in the son, his youngest brother, and says, here, this whorehopper, this one who has wasted, in fact, he says he has devoured your living with harlots. When he came home, you have killed the fatted calf for him. And listen, you don't have to do anything but read that to find it just dripping with sarcasm and with hatred. And so he stands there, having made the judgment final, this one of yours who has devoured your living with harlots. He makes the separation fairly complete when he says, your son. He doesn't even call him his own brother. He says, this son of yours who has devoured your living with harlots. When he came, you gave him the fatted calf. And all his father could say was, well, it was appropriate that we do this. This boy's back home. It was appropriate that we make merry and rejoice. But the son would not go in. And the father had to go around, had to turn around and go back into the house without him. And so we find him standing there, sore, hurt, disgruntled, angry, hateful, feeling that he had been taken advantage of, sullen, pouting, pulling away the shoulder, and refusing to open his heart to his brother. We find him alienated from his father, alienated from his brother, alienated from his own home. We find him the prodigal who would not come home. And he would not change. This is the way the parable ends. With him on the outside, his wasteful, penitent brother on the inside, with his father, with the food, with the warmth, with the love, and him standing on the outside in the cold, lonely, lost, miserable. What a sad ending. Now I want you to look at him real carefully this morning. What was the matter with him? What was the sin of this young man? We know what his brother's sin was. Oh, there was no real hiding that, I think. The father had it recorded here that he had wasted his substance in riotous living. He doesn't go into a lot of detail. He doesn't parade it before all of us. He leaves it to our discretion, I think, to surmise what happened. But the son also, when he came home, he said, Father, I've sinned against you and against heaven. And now the son, who is the older brother, said exactly and specifically what his sin was. He said, he's devoured your living with harlots. I wonder how he knew that. I wonder why he didn't say, this son of yours who has wasted your money in horse racing. or who's wasted your money in gin rummy and gambling, or who has wasted your money in a lot of other ways. I wonder why he said he's wasted it in this thing of harlotry. I wonder if perhaps he was not seeing so much of what was in the younger son as he was seeing a reflection of what perhaps was in himself, way deep down inside, and that's really what he would have done had he gone away and wasted any money. I don't know. But there he stood. The sins of the younger brother are evident. What were his sins, though? Well, there were many things that were wrong with him. There were many sins that he was guilty of. Really, there were just two, though, upon which all the others hang. Number one, this young man failed to love his father, and he failed to love his brother. That's about all that was wrong with him. And it's on these two, of course, that all the other sins of humanity hang. It's on these two that all the rest of the law and the prophets hang. He didn't love his father. I know that he didn't. But you say, now, wait a minute. You're criticizing him and you're overly critical of him. The young boy, he stayed at home. That's right. This boy worked. That's right. And he obeyed every command of his father. That's right. But you know, it's not surprising to see that you can do all of these things and still not love God. You can stay in the church. You can stay at home. You can work and be industrious. You can obey every command. And yet, like the writer said in the 1 Corinthian letter, though I speak with the tongue of men and of angels but don't have love, I become like a sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. And though I bestow all of my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned but don't have love, it profits me nothing. You see, you can do all of these things and not love. This young man showed that he didn't love his father by his actions. First of all, he didn't love his father for this simple reason. He would not have embarrassed his father like he did had he loved him. Picture in your own mind, if you will, between the father going out to the barn where the boy was sitting there pouting. Picture the distance from there back to the guest house where they were having the feast. Picture the remorse, or the sadness and sorrow, rather, of the father as he made this transition from the pouting, sullen son back into the sunlight of the feast. Will you think for just a moment at how embarrassed he was? Think for a moment of his mind as he made his way back from the sullen, disobedient son into the feast. I know what he was thinking. What am I going to say? How am I going to explain this to my younger son? What in the world will I say to the family? And he was totally embarrassed. You know he was. This boy would not have embarrassed his father had he loved him. Secondly, he would not have reproved his father had he loved him. He rebuked him. He said, "You never gave me anything like that." But when this one who has devoured your living with harlots, when he came, you've been overly splurging with him, and you have shown that you yourself are prodigal. You're wasteful yourself. You talk about him. This is your son. He's just like you. He didn't go into all that detail, but he identified this prodigal son and this father as being father and son. He would have bridled his tongue had he loved his father. Thirdly, I don't think he loved his father for the simple reason that he didn't love the ones whom his father loved. You can't love someone without loving those whom he loves. This father loved this younger boy. Don't tell me that this older boy did not see the sadness in the father's face as this younger boy went off down to the far country. He knew. Don't think that he didn't watch him as he stood there looking down the road many a day, day in and day out, looking for the return of that boy. He knew. He just didn't care. He didn't love the one whom his father loved. I say that these things add up to the fact that this boy really didn't love his father. Oh, he stayed at home. He worked. He was obedient. But you can do all of that and still not really and truly love your father. But this boy, neither did he love his younger brother. He was not able to put himself in the position of his younger brother and understand him. he wasn't able to empathize with him. You know, when Jesus said, as you would that men should do unto you, you do so to them, he was saying, try to empathize, try to feel with that other person so that you can put yourself in their shoes, so that you will know how that you would want someone to treat you were you in their situation and they in yours. But he never thought of himself ever being in that situation. He never considered that he was ever in such a situation as being in sin. That's why he couldn't sympathize with someone who was in sin. He's the one that John spoke of in 1 John 3:17 when he says, if any man has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? The prodigal brother who stayed at home is that one that John talked about. Not able to open up, not able to empathize. He didn't love his father, and he didn't love his brother. A lot of other sins stem from it, but these are the two basic ones. Two or three sins that stem from it are these. He was hypercritical. He was one who was willing to stand and pick a mote out of someone's eye or a little speck while a beam was in his own eye. He was one who would stand and justify himself that he was righteous and then discount or despise or look down upon everybody else. Now the contemporary, or his parallel really in this, is found in Luke the 18th chapter, where Jesus saw some of these people who, it says, justified themselves that they were righteous and they despised everybody else. In other words, they are always in the right and everyone else is in the wrong. This man was hypercritical. Do you recognize that as sin? I really wanted to mention another one first, because you'll recognize this first one, I think, as sin. He was unforgiving. Oh, right. Okay, now we're off on the right track. He was unforgiving. You know that's sin, don't you? You know that Jesus Christ said, if you don't forgive your brother, neither will your father forgive you. You know the parable of the two stewards or the two servants who owed the Lord, one of them owed him some $10 million. One of them then owed this other servant, he owed him $17. And you know how the Lord forgave the one servant of the $10 million, and that servant went out then and choked the one who owed him $17 and said, forgive me or pay me. And he said, well, I will if you'll just give me time. But he wouldn't. He threw him in jail. You know how the Lord said, that's what the Lord is going to do to you. He summoned this fellow in and said, what are you doing, you wicked servant? I forgave you all of this. Couldn't you forgive your brother of this little debt that he owed you? And he threw him in jail. He said, my Father's going to do that to every one of you if you don't forgive every brother that sins against you. Out of your heart, forgive him. He was unforgiving, and I think we'd recognize that as one of his sins. But the second one that I mentioned, that of being overly critical, is that a sin too? Yep, that's a sin. Jesus talks about not making righteous judgment, but he talks about this thing of judging other people in the sense that you condemn them and that you refuse to let them inside you. It's one thing to recognize that a person has sinned and go to him and tell him of his sin and say to him, but look, we all sin. Don't worry about it. Just repent of it and let's get right. I'm not any better than you are. And this boy, if he had gone to his father and said, Father, he's wasted a third of your income. He's done all of these things and it breaks my heart. But I've forgiven him. I've wrestled with it and I'm ready to take him back. Let's go out and help him come in. That would have been something else entirely. But this boy said, no, I'll have nothing to do with him. He was hypercritical. He was unforgiving. He was hypercritical. Then I'm going to mention a third one that you may not even think is a sin. He was unjoyful. Unjoyful. He was sad. Well, is sadness a sin? Yeah. At least being unjoyful. The word doesn't mean, it's not mentioned in here. Sad isn't. But unjoyful is. The word unjoyful isn't even mentioned, but it says he was angry and he would not go in. But I want to show you something. This boy could not find himself able to rejoice over the return of a sinner. Now that's ungodliness. You know why? This whole chapter, of the 15th chapter of Luke, is built around this one simple theme. God is a God who loves and rejoices at the return of sinful people. That's what this whole thing is about. 10 times in this one chapter, these words are used. Joy,
rejoice, make merry, be glad, music, dancing, all these symbols and expressions of joy and rejoicing and absolute hilarity that was all of these. And you know who they're descriptive of? They're descriptive of God. That's the kind of God we serve. This is the way Jesus introduced this thing. The tax collectors and the sinners were all drawing near to him, and the Pharisees and scribes murmured, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." So, the next word is so, he told them this parable. What man of you, having 100 sheep, if he's lost one, doesn't leave the 99 and go after the one which is lost, and brings it back when he finds it, and calls his neighbors and says, "Rejoice with me, I found my sheep which was lost." Just so I tell you, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. He says that's going to happen in heaven. That happens around the throne of God. This is an attribute of God, this thing of being able to rejoice at sinners coming home. And this boy couldn't do that. This boy then was an ungodly person. Ungodly in the sense that he couldn't find it in him to rejoice and be happy. And that's a sin. Sure, it's a sin. Now, finally, who was this boy? Who was this prodigal? We saw the story of his life and we've seen what his sin was, but I want to know who he was. Otherwise, this will be just simply a story. You know, a parable is two stories. It's one of them thrown alongside another one. We've noticed the one of them. Now, what about the one that's thrown along the side? Who is the prodigal boy that stayed home? Well, he was the Jew of Jesus' day, the religious person of Jesus' day. Now, that was what occasioned this very parable here. As I said, that the Pharisees and Sadducees, when they saw that the sinners were coming near to Jesus to hear him, they said, "This man receives sinners." Well, maybe that was not really typical of these people. No, it was typical. Everywhere you go, especially in Luke's gospel, you find this was the typical way they responded. Zacchaeus climbed down out of a tree with joy and joyfully received Jesus into his house. And there were the presidents of the Sourpuss Society looking on. Look at him. He's eating with sinners. They weren't able to do that. They weren't able to be joyful. No, this was typical of them. A prostitute came into the room one night with Jesus there in the home of Simon the Pharisee. They were eating and talking, and here came this intruder. She came and knelt back behind Jesus where his feet were as they reclined at table. And she began to pour her heart out and began to cry. And the tears fell on his feet, it says. And she kissed his feet. And she wiped his feet with her hair. And Simon said, this settles two issues. I know now that he's not a prophet, for if he were a prophet, he would know what kind of a woman this is that's touching him. He wasn't happy. Jesus said, "Simon, I have something to say to you." He said, "Go ahead." He said, "Do you see this woman? When I came into your house, you didn't wash my feet. And yet, she has washed my feet with her tears and dried them with her hair. You didn't kiss me, but she has kissed me, my feet. She has not ceased to kiss my feet." And then he said, "Simon, he who is forgiven little, loves little. He who is forgiven much, loves much. This woman's sins that are many are forgiven because she's loved much." And so we find this man standing there on the outside, lost, unforgiving, sad. He was the religious Jew of his day, not able to receive sinful people to himself, not able to understand how anybody else could, and alienated from the God that did that very thing. In Luke, the 18th chapter, there's another parallel story. The two men that went up to pray. The elder brother stood up and prayed and said, "I'm glad I'm not like other men. I'm glad I'm not like these men that are tax collectors, fornicators. He names a whole list of them, or even like this man here, the tax collector. That was the elder brother that stood up and prayed. And then the elder brother, pointing to the younger brother, separated himself from him, because it says that the younger brother was standing way off, and he prayed, "Oh God, be merciful to me, a sinner." That's all he prayed. But here the two brothers are again. Oh, they're not named that in Luke 18, but that's who they are. He was the religious man of his day. Who is the prodigal brother who stayed at home? Well, he's the religious person, the average religious person of every day, of every age. People aren't much different. Most people who have come to be religious have fallen into the rut, most prominent rut of religion. And that is, they've developed into a self-righteous person where they forget that they themselves once were sinners and that they themselves are still sinners. They represent, or he represents, the basic, what you would call the average religious person of every age. He represents the average church. And I say average, not in the sense of condemning the whole church, but I'm saying that unless you arise and get above what is the normal trend or tendency in our lives, unless you get above that, you're going to be one of these prodigal brothers who stayed at home. He's the average church today. We don't spend much time out among the prodigal sons. We don't spend much of our sympathy on those people who are the real social outcasts of the world. We just don't do it. We spend more of our time around those people that we know are good people that ought to become Christians. And we often send our preachers, "Go get that man and go convert him. He's such a good man. He ought to be a Christian." Have you ever heard anyone say, "Go and get that drunkard. He's the worst fellow in town. He ought to be a Christian." Did you ever hear anyone? In all of my 20 years of preaching, I have never had anyone tell me, "You ought to go get that fella. He's the worst sinner in town. He needs to be a Christian." I have had them tell me many times, "Go get so-and-so. He's one of the finest men in town. He ought to be a Christian." The elder brother, I think, is an average church. The elder brother is an average Christian. He's an average church member who doesn't really find that he's able to rejoice with a sinner who returns. Now, you may think, "Well, now you're condemning me overly much." Not really. Oh, we find ourselves able to rejoice, provided it's not about 10 after 12 when the fellow responds and comes down the aisle. If it happens to be 15 after 12 and people are still responding, you know what we do? Well, we say, "Surely not another one." And we look at our watches and we think, "Well, I'll never get there today." Or if one responds, we say, "Oh, yeah, I know him, sure." Or she responds, and we say, "Well, we'll see. Now look, I myself have had these very same feelings. Don't sit there and tell me that you haven't. This prodigal brother who stayed at home is the average mother and father who has a prodigal son or daughter. Now, I say average again in the sense not that maybe it's the average numerically, but that unless you arise above that which is the human reaction of a selfish individual who has been hurt, you'll find yourself wanting to pay retribution. You'll find yourself not wanting to accept them. Just recently in this very community, I think we have seen some people rise above the normal, above the average. And I've asked the mother of this young girl if I might mention it. She said, "By all means." There's a young girl in our community who is expecting a baby. She's out of wedlock. I talked with the mother this week, and she said, in all of this great tragedy, She said, I have never known that love could exist like it exists here. She said, all of my friends, people that I didn't even know were my friends, came by, called me, sat with me, wept with me, and said, they put their arm around me in a way that I never knew it could exist. She said, not only that, but the friends of my daughter, her schoolmates in school, they have all been so beautiful. Said they have all expressed such concern and care. And she said, the love is so genuine. She said, I would never have believed it had it not happened to me. Now that's good. And we all ought to act like that. And I commend you for it. I'll tell you what, it's made a believer out of this woman. She said, I will never be the same person again. And that was because an elder brother didn't act like the one here. Now, which are you? If you had to write on a card, I am the prodigal son who has gone away and I'm so sorry and I've come home. Or would you have to write on there, it is my nature to be the elder brother. I'm hypercritical, I'm unforgiving, and I just really don't find much joy out of anybody. I'm an unhappy person. Which would you have to say is you? One man came up after the service, at the first service, and said, you missed me both ways. He said, I'm both of those. He really meant I hit him both ways. He said, but when you gave the alternatives, he said, I couldn't stand on either way, on either side, because I had to say I was both of them. Now listen, you may today be in a position to be an elder brother. What are you going to do about it? When the time comes, how will you react? How will you respond? It just all depends upon what the attitude of your heart is. Don't let the word older and younger throw you, because it has no relationship to age whatsoever. There are a lot of older people who are warm and responsive and kind and tender-hearted. There are some young people who are very hardened and self-righteous and hypercritical. There are some young people who are very tender and loving and kind and responsive. And there are some older people who are as cold as a rock. But it just doesn't matter. The age doesn't determine it. It's whether or not you love God and love your fellow man. That's what will determine whether you're the elder brother who is responsive and wanting his brother to come home, or whether you stand back in the cold, lost, lonely, alienated, and damned, because that's where you're going. You're going to hell. But you need not. You can come today. It doesn't matter really what time it is. Would you come? If you need to respond in faith to be baptized into Christ, to become a Christian, we'll wait for you as a prodigal son returning home. But if there are some of you who've been standing out by the barn, scratching around in the dirt, wallowing in your self-pity because, you know, you haven't been given the proper attention, you need to respond too. And as these others respond, open your heart to anybody and everybody. This is the gospel, and it's as much a part of it as any other part of the gospel. We dare not overlook it. Would you come, whether you're an elder brother or a prodigal son, come now while we stand and sing.